Welcome to Dub Labs Louder Than the Noise, a series featuring dispatches from progressive music minds in the Middle East and North Africa.
I'm Frosty. This is dublab.com, and we're connecting right now with Maha El-Nabawi. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Where in the world are you right now?
I'm in a central Cairo neighborhood called Do'i.
Beautiful. What is, just to paint a picture of where you are right now, as far as that neighborhood, what is that neighborhood within the kind of scope and spectrum of the city? And is that your home? Do you live there?
Yes, I live there. I'm originally from Cairo, born here, but moved to the States with my family when I was 3 and spent most of my formative years there and then moved back here in 2010, just before the revolution started. As for the neighborhood I'm in, it's a central downtown Cairo, close to Wust El Balad, which is downtown, which is where a lot of the culture activities happen. But yeah, it's a central Cairo neighborhood, very densely populated, very noisy, like many other neighborhoods in Cairo.
So you moved at 3 to the U.S. and, as you mentioned, spent your formative years there. How connected to Egyptian culture did you remain when you were living outside of Egypt? How much a part of your kind of the fabric of your life was, say, the ideas, the cultural ideas, or also the music and the arts?
It was always a little bit present. My parents always spoke to my brother and I in Arabic, and we'd always answer back in English. I grew up in a town in Northern Virginia, so there weren't too many other Arabs around there. But yeah, we maintained our culture well, and we tried to go back most summers. Most of my family was still here in Egypt, so the connection was still pretty strong. But I certainly did miss out on some crucial years of pop culture, absorbing more of the American MTV culture, that's for sure. So in moving back here, there was a lot of catch up to do. But it's been so fun, honestly.
So you spent a lot your formative years in the U.S. and you were studying business, I've heard. How did you then start to kind of veer into writing about music and culture? What was that kind of draw? And was that one of the impetus to then bring you back to Egypt?
Well, it was a random choice to come back to Egypt. Yes, I had studied business in undergrad and moved to New York shortly after university. And I was actually working in a fashion recruiting company. But I was always writing a bit for myself, trying to write short stories, trying to write whatever I could. And I knew that I always wanted to go further into publishing. So in New York, I ended up switching careers a bit and working within a network of a publisher who had a network of pop culture magazines, including Nylon and Tokion and Inked and Surface. I think the only ones that exist still are Nylon and Inked. So there I was working more on integrated marketing, but the editorial team and the publishing team worked quite closely together. They were quite integrated. So I became more interested in pursuing publishing. And at a certain point, it was a sort of now or never decision to move back to Cairo for a year. That was the aim. And then I moved back in 2010, and a year later, the uprisings began. And very early on, I went down, I think maybe on the second or third day. It was actually pretty much, I know exactly the day, it was on the 28th, and the uprisings had already started on the 25th. But on the 28th, we woke up, and the internet was cut, and mobile phones were cut. And I got a little bit American about it. I was like, you know, like, what do you mean the internet's cut? You know, it was very shocking to me. So I felt if I felt this disenfranchised over something as privileged as internet and mobile phones, that I wanted to go down and participate in these protests. And I think it's a little bit like An activist I know once said, Ala Abdel Fattah, he said, activism is a one-time choice. It's this time you go down and you see these horrible acts of violence. And it, for me personally, it forever kind of shifted the course of my life. And in that process, I began trying to document as much of the music scene as possible. So it was very clunky at first in my journalistic pursuits because I had no training or background in it, just a huge passion for music and a curiosity for it. So it started like that, really, in 2011. I started documenting a lot of the scene that was going on and have been in the time since. Yeah, that's pretty much how it all went down.
When you made your way down to the uprisings, was this in the famous Tahrir Square that you were heading to? And were you at that moment, the Mahal Nabawi, were you in the shoes of did you feel, even if it was, you know, a upstart journalist, or did you feel you were at that moment an Egyptian American? Were all of these things kind of together? What did you kind of feel as you were walking into that space?
Oh, it was a stew of emotions, I think. Identity has always been a bit of a question mark for me, you know, being born here in Egypt and growing up in the States and having the privilege to go back and forth. But like I said, it was really a decision out of solidarity and curiosity to go down. And pretty soon after seeing certain acts of violence, it shifted my priorities and even my sense of identity a bit. I definitely felt on the fringe of things. At certain times, I even felt a little bit phony going down to protest because I had just moved back. So it's not as though I was so heavily invested into the country at that point. But it was at that time, you know, a sweeping movement, and it was hard to ignore. I wonder now if I would go down still, or if I would go down for future protests. I'm really not sure. It's also become almost impossible to protest. I mean, it's really like a near death sentence if you will go down there. No one's really protesting these days. It's quite a clamp down on it.
So why music? And was there and is there a power in music that you consider to be effective in maybe socio-political or even just emotional, personal? What was the decision to grasp onto music as your focal point?
Music is a huge part of Egyptian culture. And in the protests, there was often, you know, in Tahrir Square, there were often I think so many musicians that young musicians that were active at the time would bring their guitars down, would perform in the square. And so it was very present, and it was a very strong device to gather people and to express. But for me, it's really less about music is less, and particularly in later years, has become less about politics and more just about the basic emotions that are present with it and how it speaks to those emotions, how it represents marginalized voices and different vernaculars that don't otherwise get that presence through Egyptian media or what have you. So I could see in the early days of going on that there was a strong underground scene that had been forming from far before the revolution. It had been forming since the 90s. But the revolution did, in a way, give it more platform to some degree. And I think, as the story usually goes, most people are aware that with revolutions come music. And so the audience really opened up their ears a lot more and were eager to hear these sounds that were coming from beyond the typical pop or shabby music. Shabby music is really like folk music or working class music, or music from working class neighborhoods. People like Ahmed Adawiyah and such. I could see very early on that music was a big thing in Egypt. And I also noticed that whilst there was documentation, of course, in Arabic, there's very little documentation in English on these alternative music landscapes. And I had started to connect with a lot of the musicians just either from protesting or from journalism in general. And quickly on, I found that, yes, there was this sort of gap in English language documentation on the scene. And I just tried as vigilantly as possible to cover as much of that as I could. When I go back and look at those old pieces, I kind of want to like punch younger Maha in the face. She was very romantic and idealistic and didn't quite have the craft of writing. But yeah, it's all been a process. I've always been a bit wary of political music and particularly in the aftermath of the revolution. I try to document more things that I find have artistic integrity versus a political message. And it's quite a big divide here in Egypt in the aftermath of the revolution.
Politics, though, can take many forms, or the voice of protest can take many forms. And you mentioned also that there was a tradition, you know, in the 90s and onward, but there's also further back as well. There's Sheikh Imam, and there's also, you know, throughout time and space, music as a voice for opposition. And that can be a voice, even a romantic opposition or even internal conflict, and music as a way to kind of work through conflict and to voice, you know, that's how music has blossomed. And Egypt has a deep heritage that it seems contemporary artists are dipping into these older forms. Maryam Saleh has worked to present Sheikh Imam's music and recontextualize. And so it's this kind of continuum that people seem to be building on. How present is Egypt's past in the music? Because music is ephemeral as well. Music is invisible and floating in the air. And there's elements of Egypt's past that are very physical. I mean, you can think of maybe the pyramids as this most iconic thing when people think of the world. That's something that came before that's very visible. But music floats and disappears. But how concrete is the past of music within people's contemporary mindsets?
Of course, it's still very much present. And when I say the difference between sort of political music versus the other contemporary forms, artists like Maryam Saleh or Dina al-Wadidi, they started, I think, even before the revolution, and particularly Maryam Saleh, in appropriating songs by Sayyid Darwish or by Sheikh Imam and rearranging them, building some, you know, modernized textures upon them. And I think they have done a really excellent job, because it was when they first started, they were really working with these sort of lyrics. And in the time since, they've started to work with different contemporary poets that also speak very clearly to the sociopolitics of the time in a way that is so much more substantial than, let's say, someone like Rami Assam or Kairoki even, and I can expand on those guys later. Maryam and Dina have both worked with poets like Mido Zohair and Omar Mustafa, Michael Adil, and in looking at their poetry, which especially someone like Mido Zohir, who started from before the revolution with a band called Black Tima, writing for them, you can really trace back the frustrations of Egyptian youth and also, you know, the abstract ways in which they write because of our limited freedom of expression. But at the same time, even through their abstraction, we're able to really, you know, hone in on this very disenfranchised youth in a very similar way that Sheikh Imam and Sayyid Darwish did before. So in using their lyrics in the beginning, I think it was a stepping stone for them to begin songwriting and interpreting these lyrics. Now in the time since, like I said, artists like Dina and like Maryam have begun to write their own lyrics and work with other contemporary poets that are a bit more relevant. But when it comes to Sheikh Imam and Sayyid Darwish, they're always going to go with times of uprising and social unrest, because their music is timeless. Their lyrics are timeless. And it is still a bit of like a precarious relationship between the past and the present of Arabic music, and sort of the crisis of authenticity and and the continuity with respects to traditional forms. You know, some there's a camp that feels that all musicians should be aware, even if their music doesn't explicitly reflect a traditional Egyptian music, that they should at least have an understanding of the lineage that came before them. And then you have another camp that really just could care less about this and just want to make music. So it's a bit of, it's a constant discussion here, actually, about this sort of thorny relationship and whether we do have to link music, modern music, to this golden age of Egyptian music or even pre-Umm Kulthum. Whether we should, you know, reject the past and acknowledge kind of the impossibility of returning to these previous music traditions. But you see it, you know, it's really quite ranged. You have artists that are making something completely divorced from, aesthetically divorced from traditional music. And then you have others like Nedel Şezli, who finds inspiration through the mythology of previous musicians or musicians that came before her. Although aesthetically, aside from her music being in the makam scale, aesthetically it sounds very progressive and contemporary, but like I said, she's more found an appropriation of methods, which is this sort of like free improvisation and collaborative, this sort of music as a collaborative space and music production as a collaborative space. So it really ranges across the board.
So people talk about this golden age of Egyptian music, you know, in many ways, people are saying 1920s to 1950, but the beginning of that, in the 20s, that's already 100 years ago. Times through technology and many other forms have changed so rapidly since, even in the past, you know, 20 years. But 2011, with the uprising, that seems like that must be such a distinct moment within the landscape. Did you feel that the shift from the appropriation, the kind of almost cover songs of existing material, older material, did it shift at that point to the more original kind of contemporary lyrics and poets? Was the 2011 uprising a moment that started propelling people even faster to progress what they were doing and saying, even at great risk?
I'm sure a little bit, but I'm wary to give the revolution and the uprisings too much weight towards contemporary Egyptian culture. So many of the musicians that we see present now, be it musicians like Maurice Lua or Nedel Şezli or Meryem Saleh or Temer Ebu Ghazela and Zuli, Abusif, so many of these people were working already in music before the revolution started, but it's their timeline matched up with it. So they continued to develop in the years that have passed since 2011. And it's hard to say, because it's not as though there wasn't anything in between Sheikh Imam and Sayyid Darwish and let's say Mido Zohir, who started in the, let's say, later 90s, early 2000s with this very incredible, incredible poetry. I wouldn't call it nihilistic, but I would call it dystopic a bit and surrealist and all of these things. But what the revolution did was, for a brief moment in time, it did open up moments of freedom of expression where people, for some a few years, did feel like they could be more explicit in their critiques. But I feel the people who have really survived and developed and succeeded are people who are not singing political music. It has become a bit of a trope and a bit of a meme to sing political music. I mean, you have some people who still, you know, who managed to ride that wave and still continue to be popular, like a Kairoki. Kairoki has a huge fan base, but they really did ride that wave in the beginning. And yet they're really not my taste, but their new album, a lot of people who had been against Kairoki have like Kairoki again. You have another sort of meme musician called Rami Assam, who began singing in the square, in Tahrir Square, He was basically taking like the main protest chants and putting it to like three chords, no melody, no chorus, no, it's not a song, you know, it was nothing in the structure of a song was present there. And he basically made his whole identity out of being this quote unquote voice of the revolution. But the revolution's beauty and its failing is maybe a bit of a bold statement to say this, but that it was, there was no voice of the revolution. And someone like Rami Assam continues to make political music while living abroad in Sweden. And he recently released this song called Balaha that is a sort of critique of the president. And the thing is like a parody. It's like something you would see on Saturday night. He's like a parody of himself. And the sad part is that so many people got arrested for this song, even people who had nothing to do with the song. This guitarist named Rami Sidi, who once worked with him in the past and broke ties with him in 2013 due to artistic differences, was somehow arrested in relation to this song and remains in jail and doesn't even have a case against him. He's every 45 days he goes to see what the case is going to be, and then they put him back in jail. So he's been in jail for like 9 months now for a song he had nothing to do with and doesn't even artistically value. Meanwhile, Rami Assam is in a asylum in cultural asylum in Sweden and continues to make this music. And it's less about artistic choice. It's more about also, you know, the responsibility that he has to his collaborators. And at the same time, no one that works really within music in Egypt values this kind of art. That's not to say that music can't be political. I think we just got exhausted by the weaponization of music and also people riding that wave. So what's become much more interesting is the people who, if they are discussing sociopolitics, are much more subversive, are much more literary about it. Again, I point to people like Mido Zohir, who again doesn't even per se write about politics, but he really vocalizes sentiments of youth culture here. And Maryam Saleh continues to do the same. Din al-Wadidi continues to do the same. But as for political music, like I said, it's become a bit of a trope and it's not something I care so much to even document that much anymore. There's so much music production happening here that is on such a high artistic level or is so powerful and ubiquitous, like Mahraganat, that's really where the excitement is in electronic, in neo folk, and shabby pop, these types of genres.
The idea of this kind of almost inner landscape or something that is a little more fluid, a little more mysterious. You've written about the kind of surrealist streak within Cairo and some of these interesting musicians. You mentioned earlier Nada El Shazli and Maurice Luca and Maryam Saleh. Tell us a bit about that kind of undercurrent and what draws you to that world. You were writing about it even a couple of years ago, but has it grown and blossomed since then? You wrote a beautiful piece called Sands of Time that appeared in 2018 in The Wire. But how about that kind of surrealist streak within Egyptian music?
Yeah, I mean, I find it present across several albums, you know, with lyrics of like from Tambur Abu Ghazala, who released an album years ago called Tooth. And even then, in his lyric writing, you know, you have fish falling from the sky. And in Neda's lyrics, you know, you have these like temporal and ontological conundrums that she's sort of reconciling. Same with Mido's music and Omar Mustafa's poetry that gets appropriated to song as well. I think the idea also of psychedelia, and I don't per se mean it as a Western term, I'm just using that term of lack of better word, has always been present in Egyptian culture, especially when you look back at, you know, ritual music from Zar to the Moolid music. You know, music has always been used in rituals here, and to basically alter your state of mind. And so psychedelia is very rooted within Egyptian culture. And it's a term that I struggle with because I'd like to find an Egyptian term, because I think it's actually an Egyptian concept that precedes the American concept of it, just as much as it was an Indian concept before it was an American concept. And there's so it's definitely present within the music. And there's also this idea, too, that within Egyptian and Arab culture in general, we're not allowed to be as explicit with our lyrics of social or political critique, generally speaking. So you have to find these metaphors. You have to find these double entendres. You have to find these references. And it's really a poetic culture. So I find the people who are really excelling in songwriting are people who really, you know, access those literary devices, if not them writing themselves, but knowing which poets to work with. And then on a musical end, on an aesthetic end, Cairo is an acid trip on its own, you know.
Tell us about if you're, you know, just traveling through the city, say you walk out your front door, you go to a neighborhood that you frequent, if it's Agusa or different places. Tell us about the vibes on the street, the sounds. What is that acid trip like, or what is that street life like?
Well, it's really an absurdist culture. I mean, I sometimes, you know, when you read something like Kafka, and if you live in like a very bubbled life in the West or something, you might be like, God, man, this guy is the greatest of fictional minds. And he is. But living back in Egypt, I realized that the reality is so much more absurd than any fiction. And that must have been what he was doing, is fictionalizing his reality. And you see this so present in Egypt between, you know, how the constitution is like a chalkboard. One minute they write an amendment, they erase the amendment, they add a new one, they add a law without adding bylaws. You know, when you walk down the street in Egypt, I always say it's a bit like I think Mario Kart, if that game still exists, should make a Cairo level, a Cairo theme, because when you're driving, there's so much traffic and you never know what's going to cross the street in front of you. Like, a car might cut you off from left to right. There might be a donkey crossing the street. There might be, people selling flowers at your window. There's all sorts of chaos that's constantly happening. And it's a very noisy city as well. I think at 3 a.m. and at 3 p.m., you'll probably hear the exact same amount of noise. I don't think that there's one second in this city where a horn is not honking. I think it's constant. And with that now, you know, it's such a high traffic culture. You're also very aware of what music is coming out of these cars. And I'd say since 2010, that music, and particularly since 2011, since it started to develop more, that music has been a genre called mahraganat, which is festival music that started in the Ashwayet, which are like the informal settlements or the informal communities informal neighborhoods in Egypt. Ghettos, let's say, but I'd rather not use that word. I'm just giving you that context. So a lot of this music has come out of those neighborhoods, and it started in weddings and started in festivals there. And now it's ubiquitous. I mean, you cannot walk down the street without hearing mahraganat, without hearing artists like Sadet or 50 or Sawarikh or Matfageya. It's really ubiquitous.
And what is the kind of sonic nature of festival music? If you were to explain it to people who don't have the context, what's the kind of rhythmic nature? Tell us a bit about it.
Well, it's somewhat rooted in shabi music. So going, you know, shabi music goes very far back in Egyptian culture. But let's say when shabi music started to become more like on the fringe of pop as well, or as ubiquitous as pop, I don't mean content wise, started, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s. And now this younger generation is basically making an electronic form of this. It's always this music that is from the margins, and the artists that create this music have their own vernacular. vernacular, and they have their own lingo, and they really reflect the voice of the youth, of the populace of the youth, particularly a male perspective. There's has yet to be any women really to permeate that scene so much on a wide level, like on a public level, which is, you know, a discussion we can get into a little later. But the music itself, it still sounds rooted in Arabic textures, but it's very electronic and it's fast and it's loaded with sub bass and it is extremely powerful. And even if you don't understand the lyrics of the music, it is impossible not to dance to it. It's true dance music. And people like Islam Chipsy, who is more instrumental, he plays the keyboard and he has two drummers with him. The rhythm structures are very Egyptian. It's that dom taka, you know, it's very Egyptian in the structure. But it's loaded with sub bass and it's really within those Egyptian, rhythmic structures. And even texturally, like we have something called the sago, which is like the finger symbol that like sound. And even the sort of electronic texturizing of that is present in it. So it's very localized music. It's very Egyptian, but it's also very modern in the sense of it's using these guys when they started are using Fruity Loops and pirated softwares. And yeah, it is the largest genre now of alternative music. And it's only alternative because it's still not accepted into the mainstream for the same reasons that Ahmed Adawiyah wasn't accepted into the mainstream in the 70s and 80s, because it's, you know, highbrow culture considers it lowbrow and vulgar and not representative of this warped framing of Egyptian culture that this larger society has, the larger high society and the government have. So these mahraganat artists, like Adawiyah and his time, they never get on the airways, they never get on TV. And if they get on TV, they're like usually made fun of, you know, they're invited on and the presenter will in some subversive way make fun of them. So it's these guys are genius though. I mean, they have really taken it into their own hands, and due to technology and their ability to represent themselves, they don't even need mass media. They are mass media now. I mean, they're getting millions and millions of views. And the videos that they're producing are incredible, and they really speak to the youth. Again, the problem with mahraganat, the one problem I find, is the lack of women in the scene, very similar to when hip-hop first started. But even when Western hip-hop started, the women were always there. They were just masked, you know. But in Egypt, I'm struggling to find women present in this scene, because of also the social dynamics of you know, women in Egypt. It's a hard scene for them to enter. If a woman from a working class neighborhood is going to go into music, she'll more likely go into shabby music or into pop music, for many reasons, because mahraganat on a large scale is still looked a bit down upon from Egyptian society and is not considered a space where women should be in, which I find also a bit absurd. But I understand it, you know, but I'd really like to see it happen. And yeah, so it's really a hero story with this mahraganat music. And I'm sure the women will come in time. But there's a label named 100 Copies who has been doing a lot of work in focusing on this scene. I'm not sure if you came across the name Mahmoud Rifat. I've worked a lot with Mahmoud over the years. And Mahmoud started as he's a musician himself. He was in a band with Maurice Lua called Bikya. He had loads of projects and always had this label. And as mahraganat started to become more popular, he started working with a lot of these artists and has really been one of the few people who is able to create somewhat of an industry around alternative music with these artists. They're traveling abroad. I think that even a few years ago, he got them a distribution deal with Sony. The internet shows the popularity of these artists. It's quite remarkable.
The sounds like, although maybe on the this upper crust level, more kind of this established society or this elite society, which usually tends to also be kind of crooked and corrupt. The Maharaganat kind of sound isn't been embraced and even been shunned, but it seems like this is really the kind of reflection of, you know, kind of street level popular culture. I love that you've got this quote here you wrote about Islam, Gypsy. His rhythms burst with a sense of resistance, creating a sort of militant yet playful soundscape that reminds me of something John Cage said in 1939, percussion music is a revolution. And so sometimes it seems that it's not this tired kind of trope of singing a protest song where it's on the surface, but the actual kind of rhythmic nature and the energetic reflection of the youth, that seems to be powerful. You know, many forms of music have come before where it's bubbled from the underground up. Is this that kind of representation of youth revolution to you?
I mean, if you remove revolution from politics, you know, it is a revolutionary in the sense that it is breaking molds and creating something new. As for is it a political music? I mean, in Egypt, almost
not,
every act
political, as in overtly political, but even just a reflection of the freedom to have an energetic music form that is your own.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's really giving voice to it's really giving a platform to marginalized voices, and so that's ultimately the politics involved in it. And in Egypt, every performance that an artist gives is a political act because of the difficulty in actually performing legally in Egypt due to this kind of horrific structure of a body of government called Musannafat, which is part of the music syndicate. But usually a music syndicate or any syndicate is supposed to defend its network or its representatives from the government or from the industry itself. This syndicate is actually part of the government, and musicians are required to get a license in order to legally perform. But the catch-22 is that only musicians who play basically like traditional instruments, even be it guitar, basic instruments, are kind of allowed to apply for that, because there is no panel of jurors to judge a DJ or a person working with machines or a person working with pads or a person working with software. The music syndicate's judgment board doesn't validate those types of music. So when a musician goes to perform, there's always the risk that the Musannafat is going to come. And so every act of performance is a political act in a way. So yeah, I mean, it's really hard to remove the politics from art in Egypt. But at the same time, what I think is so incredible about Maharganat is there's also, because they're not on mainstream channels, there's no self-censorship. You know, they really say what they want to say. At the same time, usually it's not about attacking the president or about that, but it is a very, you know, it's a voice that really reflects the youth, a very, you know, frustrated youth, but also a youth that is resilient and still just knows how to dance when it comes down to it.
And what are the self-published kind of networks? Is this going, is it YouTube? Is it SoundCloud? What is the kind of prime network for the kind of distribution of the music?
Yeah, for the most part, it's YouTube. When you're talking about Maharganat and even hip hop, it's largely YouTube, SoundCloud. Those who are looking to sell albums largely work with Bandcamp. I think Bandcamp has a great model because you can list your own price for the album. Like as an artist, when you put it on there, you know, you can, I mean, you can make a minimum and a person can come on and say, hey, I'll pay $1 or $5. Also Bandcamp, if you listen to a song a few times, it will ask you to open up your wallet. On the general scale in how Egyptians are consuming this music, it's largely through YouTube. It's also largely through, you know, they pirate the music, put it on USBs. That's why you hear it in the tuk-tuks and in the taxis a lot. So the main distribution channels are largely SoundCloud, YouTube, Spotify and Remy and Deezer have come into the mix as well. But I don't think any artist here is really, like artists everywhere, are not really monetizing off those platforms. In fact, they're monetizing way more on YouTube. And of course, like in music all over the world, most of the artists are monetizing through performance versus record sales. I mean, even when you look at... I mean, you have an interesting model with people like Nada Shazli and Maurice Lua who do release, or Dina Lwedidi who do release through labels. But a lot of times on those labels, they'll maybe do a cut of like 500 vinyl and then also sell the albums online. And a lot of times they are selling out on those 500, but it's a very niche audience who's going to buy a vinyl. So most of the music is always accessed through YouTube, I'd say.
So... in 2011, when the government shuts off the internet or the phone systems, you know, it's interesting if music in its most widespread form is existing on these kind of online platforms, if it's cut off, you know, people are not able to access it. But you did mention the live form. Is there a lot of, you know, active kind of live music? Is there a network of venues that are accessible? Where is the music kind of being presented in a live form?
It's a bit of a crisis in Cairo. I mean, within the Mahraganat world, there still exists their main platforms of performance, which is within weddings in their neighborhoods. And within street festivals within their neighborhood, usually like the Mulid, the different types of seasonal festivals and such. So with wedding, Mahraganat really started in weddings because in weddings previous to Mahraganat culture, there'd be a big tacht band. So it'd be like a big band and that cost a lot more money than just hiring a DJ. So eventually when the whole DJ emergence happened, most of the weddings were hiring a DJ and then an MC who would basically sing songs to the bride and groom. And he would record those songs for them as well and give them out. And everyone in the neighborhood would end up having those songs and playing those songs. And that's really how it permeated the culture. As for where do performance exist outside of that, it is a crisis. So because of that body of government that I told you about that highly controls music, it's very difficult for live performance. We still have a few venues, but they're usually in more of the upper class realm. So you have places like the Tap or Cairo Jazz Club. Cairo Jazz Club has done a great job in just simply surviving for these past 10 years. They have an interesting model that basically on the weekend nights, they have very commercial music targeting upper class people who will come in and pay a lot for alcohol, basically. And midweek, then they open up the space that for alternative or underground musicians, and they've found an economic model that works. But most other venues either struggle economically to support alternative music because the audience is not huge and it's not a high purchasing power audience. So the spaces are often limited within these handful of venues. And like I said, I think Cairo Jazz Club does the best job, but it also has it's not the most accessible venue. In the past, there were more government spaces like Azhar and Ganena Theater, but I don't know, they've been shut down for a couple of years now and I haven't seen any events there. There's a big venue for huge, like an outdoor venue for huge pop stars. I think even Abusif actually played there, who was one of the first kind of alternative artists I saw sort of playing there outside of Kairoki and such. So the venue issue is a problem. So performance is really a struggle in Egypt. And it constantly amazes me that even without the access to performance, the amount of it's really prolific, the amount of production that's coming out of some of these artists, be it artists like from rock, which is like Yusuf Ebouzid. He's constantly releasing under so many different names on SoundCloud. There's, you know, Amr Alami, who also does this very like left field electronic music, and also constantly like very prolific in the output that he releases. So you really have a lot of music coming out. Abusif is, you know, I think Abusif is my favorite rapper these days. He's so good,
and
he
just cut off
releases
Abusif
a new track like every week.
Abusif is my favorite rapper in the
Abusif. I think Abusif and Kendrick Lamar are like my two favorite rappers throughout the world. Abusif is so good. And he used to, when he first started, was Zuli was his producer at first. And now Abusif has started producing for himself as well and working with different producers and working with younger artists. He's inspired this whole generation of Generation Z of trap rap artists, actually, many of which exist in Alexandria, from Marwan Pablo to Wiggs and Marwan Musa. And it's very trap aesthetic. Like the music itself, a lot of times, doesn't sound very Egyptian. But it sounds really good with like those rolling drums with Arabic's rolling R's sounds excellent. So my point is that the output of production is huge. As for the amount of how much of that translates to accessible performance, it's very little. Like I said, due to the government control and due to the economic systems that make it very difficult to make it cost effective to even put on a big show or even a medium sized show.
So a crisis within kind of a number of venues and lack of a distinct community in that way. But it sounds like there's little by little forming online communities. And can you talk a bit about Mada Masr? I'm not sure if I pronounced it correct. How do you say it?
Yeah, it's Mada Masr.
Mada Masr. Can you talk about Mada Masr and your role within that? And I love that this is a space that if you read if you go to Mada Masr, MADAMASR.com, and the kind of mission statement about us is a really strong voice for, you know, independent voice, and the articles that you're writing there and the information that's being shared seems like a really direct access, not only to people within Egypt, but because it's bilingual, to people outside of Egypt or the whole Middle East, North African region, to be able to access and understand more of what's happening ground level and the different strata, you know, the worlds of the kind of poetic surrealists and then the festival music, and kind of covering that broad spectrum. Tell us a bit about that project.
We started in 2013 amidst sort of like the peak of the political happenings, let's say. So we started shortly after, or the same day as I guess I should be careful about this language. So we started in 2013 on the same day that Morsi was overthrown by the military, which was backed by popular protest. So we launched on that same day, actually, and we started as about 10 co-founders. We were part of a different institution called Al Masri Yom, one of the largest independent newspapers here in Egypt, and we got collectively fired in 2012. And I think it was in some ways the best thing that could have happened to us, because we would not have been able to continue the style of reporting that we were doing there in light of the political situation. So starting Mada was really, you know, the best thing that could have happened for us. And, you know, we started off as, you know, 80% women that founded the organization, and largely journalists from different walks of life in the Arab Egyptian community, also a bunch of expats as well. And Mada has been, you know, one of the few remaining spaces of possibility in Egypt, despite the fact that we've been blocked by the government here in Egypt since 2017. I think we were one of the first websites to be blocked here. Now there's hundreds.
Maybe that shows you're doing a good job.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're some of the only people who are really writing and trying to create counter narratives to either, you know, when we started the English, we started off with Mada Masr English, and in a way it was sort of like, you know, create counter narratives against Western reportage and also against local reductionist reportage. At the same time, we knew that we were going to eventually launch the Arabic site, and that would sort of become the chief site, and that English would become secondary. And when we launched that Arabic site, I think we didn't expect to sort of garner the attention that we did. But at the same time, you know, what we're doing is it's journalism really becomes a crime in this country in simply just trying to do the basic work of creating a checks and balance towards the government, whatever government that may be. You know, our reportage on the Muslim Brotherhood was just as critical as the reportage in this current government, just as it will be in the next government. It's sort of, you know, the our basic level of criticality will always be there. But yeah, it's really a remarkable space. At the same time, it's also really difficult. You know, it's very difficult to continue to exist within a website where you're blocked to your local audience. We're constantly coming up with a new website, a new mirror site to, you know, to publish, and then that gets blocked, and we have to do another one, and it's this cat and mouse game. For a while, when we were first blocked, we were publishing only on Facebook, and what I think is funny is that each time, you know, the government tries to push us into a corner, it forces us to innovate. So I used to call Mada the analog machine, because we would write only in long form, and we weren't really adapting to digital culture, like in producing videos and multimedia content. But when we were blocked and were only publishing on Facebook, it forced us to start to publish multimedia. And now we have a show on Mada called Akhik Bir, by one of our co-founders. And he gets, you know, a massive amount of views per episode. There's also a lot more video documentation. There's a podcast. I'm actually starting a podcast. The pilot should be out soon about music, about Arabic music. So it's constantly a space for possibility and innovation and archiving. So yeah, we're constantly trying to reimagine ourselves on a day-to-day basis, because the environment forces us to do so. But yeah, we're still going.
Yeah. I mean, I think it can be, you know, it's really can be applauded, because I think that for people, when you access something on the internet, say wherever you are in the world, and if you're in, say, Denmark, and you're accessing, if it's on the internet, it seems like, oh, it exists. And it's hard sometimes to understand the nuances, or even the risks and the different kind of strata of access throughout the world. And by publishing on the internet, that's an action that in some places is not an easy action. And so the fact that this exists, and you can go on and read, for instance, these kind of dispatches from prison. There's Abdel Rahman Al Gindi, and not talking necessarily in a political form. There's one here on color synesthesia and seeing emotions in color, and so you have a young student who, you know, was arrested and has been in prison, who is voicing, you know, his kind of inner emotions and his emotional landscape, and the fact that this is available to the world is phenomenal. Hopefully this will all be available within Egypt in an open form, and it deserves to be. But the efforts are really incredible. So I want to again point people to Mada Masr. It's M-A-D-A-M-A-S-R And part of, you know, there's 100copies.com, as you mentioned, and various sites. I know I'll not say this name right, but I think it's almost intentionally meant to be that way, that Marazef, which is doing really incredible work, not translated into English mostly. It's an Arabic language site and also platform for release of music and, you know, these things that are fluid in their form, you know, releasing music, presenting shows and doing these various things. There's some interesting things popping up. You yourself are not only writing, but you're producing cultural events and bringing people together in many different forms. What is the thing that's kind of gets you up every day to do what you do and is most kind of the greatest fuel for your work?
Really, what gets me up every day is music and trying to, you know, help give platform to what I find to be really something so special in what's happening within the country and within the region, and writing in general. I love producing content. I'm working on a novella series that's a bit clunky and getting flowing. I'm also working on producing a book about music along with a podcast. So it's really the act of expression and creation that gets me up every day. And it's really the music that kind of, you know, puts me softly to bed every night. And for me, seeing a space like Ma'azif come up as well over the past years is super exciting because of, you know, there's no other Arabic language magazine documenting in the way that they are. And it's wonderful. Music is probably one of the most connective forms of art, and so yeah, I guess that's, you know, music and expression are what get me up every day.
Wonderful. Well, it's an energetic form, and the fact that you are articulating what's happening and bubbling up from the kind of underground communities, these things, it's always the things from the underground that then start to kind of rise to the top. And many of the artists, you know, with these kind of sights set on transcendence, you know, it's a big thing. And both locally and very genuinely Egyptian forms that then can start to kind of resonate around the world. Really appreciate it. You know, if people want to follow along with what Maha El-Nabawi is doing, your work's published on a variety of platforms, everything from The Wire in the UK, The Guardian, Specs, Africa Report, on and on and on and on. I urge people to follow along with Maha's work, and we're enjoying how it's all unfolding, and we appreciate you giving us a window into your world, into your community, and look forward to continuing the journey.
Thank you, and thanks for the chance to, you know, help give platform to more of these wonderful movements of music.